books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, made in association with RNIB Talking Books. Coming up today, two books on the shortlist for the Carnegie Medal for Writing: All That It Ever Meant by Blessing Musariri and The Things We Leave Behind by Claire Furness. Plus, we'll find some new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
All That It Ever Meant by Blessing Musariri is a haunting story of loss and bereavement and its impact on family dynamics, but also on the ability it holds to unite and strengthen bonds and connections. The audio version of All That It Ever Meant is read by Leah Summers.
Here is the short version. Chi Chi swore at Baba and he went mental. And she's still swearing, but he's ignoring her. He's ignoring all of us. Baba hasn't spoken to us since we left England, only to give instructions. I don't blame him. I don't feel like speaking either. Only it's hard times for Tana, but he's tired of hoping things will change and has given in. Dad, what is this? I mean, really, Dad, this is messed up. Chi-Chi is walking around the vehicle, throwing her long braids back as she peers into the door in the side. It looks like an army truck, if they were having a mobile sleepover. I want to feel some kind of way about everything, but not right now. I don't swear. I'm not cool enough and never angry enough. They're just not my words. I'd have to practice saying them, being comfortable with them, try them out and then make that commitment. I'm not looking for a relationship of any kind right now. The what, Chi-Chi is asking about, is an overland expedition truck. Baba and Babamkuru Alois are walking around it, kicking tyres as if, checking this and that and watching the gardener load up supplies. It would be exciting and fun if everyone weren't so angry and raw in the middle. Tana's eyes are huge in his little face, and for the first time in days, he's buzzing. He's never been this buzzed his whole life, I don't think. I'm happy for him.
It's a story that is being told by a young girl about the loss of their mother and how the family was struggling, and the father decided to take the children, Chi-Chi, who is the oldest, Mati, who is the middle child, who is also the narrator, and Tana, on a road trip to Zimbabwe, where they come from originally. The children are first-generation immigrants in the UK, so they are not really familiar with Zimbabwe. So their father takes them on a road trip to try and reconnect with the children after the death of the mother. And Mati, who is telling the story, is just basically going through all the events of their lives, their life with their mother. There's a lot of flashbacks and also some, you know, present moment events as they're traveling. It's a road trip. So there's a lot about where they're going, the different places they visit with their dad, and just how their relationship is starting to come back together in the space that they're in. Because it's such an internalized storytelling, there is a character who I developed as a foil to Mati Ponesa. In her narration, it's a, you know, people have called it a spirit guide, an imaginary friend. It's somebody who only Mati can see, by the name of Metkaish. They're just there to challenge a lot of Mati's observations and perceptions, and generally as a, you know, quite mystical and fabulous type of presence, just, you know, to lend a bit of whimsy to the story as well. So yeah, and then it's, you know, the resolution is how they all come to terms with the death at the end and how the family reconnects.
Our cousins are away at boarding school, so we won't see them. We're missing them by a few days. Babu Mkuru says when we get back, we'll see them. I feel like he's maybe glad they haven't come back, because he's been commiserating with Baba since he picked us up from Robert Gabriel Mugabe Airport. This morning, Baba told Chichi, "Those shots are too short." She muttered under her breath, flipped her braids at him as she walked away, but didn't change. I saw the look on Babu Mkuru's face. It said, "No child of mine would ever." He opened his mouth to speak, but Papa put a hand on his shoulder, and he kept the steam inside his own head. He's Papa's older brother. His wife, my guru Enusu, goes to work really early. But even if she had been here, she wouldn't have said anything. She's very soft and smiley and doesn't take anything too serious. When Chi-Chi was huffing around their house being a monster, she just carried about her business being nice and smiley about everything. Tana melted himself into her and soaked up all the good vibes. I want to be better to him, but it's not a good time.
We'll stay completely spoiler-free, so we'll only look at the first few chapters of the book. But it starts with a bit of a fight in the car. Was that road trip something you've done in the past?
Oh, we've done many road trips in the past. So it was so easy and almost natural to write about a road trip with a father and siblings, because that's what we used to do in our youth. My dad used to take us on a lot of road trips. So it's par for the course for me. It's, lots of squabbles, making up, having a lot of fun, new experiences, that kind of thing.
And the death of Matty's mother hangs heavy in the book. The passage about going back to school and it feels wrong for them, they're almost offended that the world has kept spinning.
Yes, because their world is in complete upheaval and nothing is the way that it should be. So it feels very strange to leave their home and go outside and find that this death that has affected them so unimaginably has not affected anybody else. So it's like, but, how can this be? It's completely opposite to what is happening to them.
Now, as you say, Matty's guided by Metacash. Where did that character actually come from?
Do you know, it's very interesting. That character just kind of popped up as I started writing. They insinuated their way into the story. And I think I've always been very taken by the notion that we have guardian angels and things like that. And I wanted some aspect of that, but I also just wanted someone that only Matty would be relating to during the story, because she's quite a fanciful child. And I was a very fanciful child, and I believed in a lot of things that people didn't see. I had like complete faith in things, like in impossible things, So Matty, I wanted her to have that sort of commitment to her own thought processes. And Metcash appeared as someone who was going to really just have conversations with Matty that are different from her interactions with her family, like completely different. And just to discuss the things that she, is talking about. But yeah, I was looking at some photographs. I think it's ethnography. And I saw these beautiful pictures of people in the Omo Valley, I think, in Ethiopia, who really adorn themselves with natural things from nature, flowers, plants, leaves. And I just thought it was just so lovely and amazing. And I wanted to incorporate some of that because I really do like art. I'm very into art and things like that. I love things that are beautiful and decorative. And I, so that's how that character developed. They also remind me a lot of my paternal grandmother, who was very pithy in a lot of her responses and in her interactions with us. So there is that tone in there that I kept.
I was going to say, did you enjoy crafting her outfits for the book?
Oh, I loved it. It's my outlet. It's my artistic outlet, my visual artistic outlet, because I always say if I hadn't been a writer. I would have been a visual artist, but I don't think I'm as good at that as I am at writing, maybe simply because it's not something I have practiced that much. But I think, I leaned more towards writing, but I still have that desire to make and craft things and paint and draw. So, yeah.
How did you actually become a writer?
It's something, I think it was like a natural compulsion that followed reading. I was an avid reader as a child. I lived for reading. I lived for books. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to sleep. I didn't want to go to school. I just wanted to read. So I was always, always, always reading. And I think that's what developed that desire to write as well. Because I always find that the more I read, the more I feel compelled to write. Even when I go through a spell when I'm not writing much, if I start to read, it'll lead me back into writing almost automatically. Yeah, so I just started. I absolutely loved English compositions. I couldn't wait for when we were given homework to write a story because I had like a very wild imagination. And I loved to express it in writing. And I loved poetry as well. I did speech and drama in junior school as an extracurricular activity. And a lot of it was learning to recite poems. And I think that also really encouraged my love for the language, the written language.
I'm having a kind of problem that no one would believe, so I've not said a word. Also, because we've all been so angry, I felt that I have to respect that dynamic for us right now. There's good reason. If I'm honest, though, I stopped being angry before we even got to Heathrow. A day or two before, actually. Because I don't really do long-range things. There's just so much going on. Who has the bandwidth for things from yesterday? It happened for the second time the night of the big fight, as I call it. Not during or before, but after. Way after. In fact, even the house had finally settled itself down after all the agitation and things were quiet, quiet. I thought I'd fallen asleep, but obviously not, because I sat right up in my bed when I smelled it. Smoke. A dank, kind of greenish, heavy smoke coming from the chair at my small desk. Now, let me tell you something about me. Nothing I feel actually ever comes out right then. Inside, it will be fight of the century, heart being all crazy in my rib cage and knocking itself about its walls, tongue in a kind of torture chamber where it's being pricked by a million hot needles. Head being squeezed by an invincible vice, while somewhere a bass drum is reverberating through my bowels, threatening to evacuate things without notice. But if you look at me, I will be still and watchful, like I'm not bothered.
Now, did you have anything to do with the casting of the audio version of the book?
No, not this one. Not this one.
Have you ever narrated any of
I
your books yourself?
This is sort of a new thing, having my books in audio, although it's something that I did think about at some point because of all the training I did with speech and drama. At some point, I did think that I would want to be a book narrator, but it's not something I've ever tried.
Oh, you should.
Oh, thank you.
Now the book is available in audio and braille. It's accessible to those who don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Yes, it is definitely. I really think that I would love for everybody to have access to my work. I mean, my own brother won't read, but he said, "Okay, but if it's on audiobook, I'll listen to it." So, just from that point of view, it's worth it to at least have people who are not big readers be able to listen to the book. Then it's for me, it's wonderful. It's amazing.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
Well, the cover is this amazingly vibrant piece of art. It's got two faces on it. It's split in half vertically, and on one side, the background is a royal No, not royal blue, but sort of. And on the other side is an orange background. And set against the orange background is Mati's beautiful face, like a headshot, as she's wearing a yellow dress with a headband that's got blue and yellow. And on the other side is the representation of Metkayish, who is this very sort of regal looking character with a fancy headdress that's got feathers and it takes up all the space around the face. And it's written in bold font, all that it ever meant in white down the middle.
There is a part of me that wasn't surprised. It's a small part that only ever raises its hand much later on after all the rest has calmed down. What I saw, when my eyes adjusted to the dimness of the nightlight, was the same thing I saw the day the whole world turned upside down, and that was in broad daylight. So how and why was this strange-looking person sitting in my room, at my desk, long into the night, smoking some ganky pipe? They hadn't looked like this that day. All dressed up in layered tassels of shimmering threads, a Viking helmet on the head of waist-length dreadlocks. I wanted to say something, but my heart got all breathless, so we looked at each other for a moment. Something in me, very far away, heard them speak. I couldn't tell you what they said. I just heard my own voice say no, and I turned away.
All That It Ever Meant is available in print as an ebook and in audio commercially, and from RNIB Library, you can get it in audio and braille. And Blessing, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
And Blessing will be back at the end of today's show with the books of my life. And coming up, we'll have Claire Furness on the Carnegie shortlisted The Things We Leave Behind. But now,
brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. John le Carré's Son has returned to the George Smiley series. Carla's Choice is by Nick Harkaway, donated by Penguin Random House.
Crossing Primrose Hill on her way to the offices of Banerty and Clay, where her employer, Mr. Banerty, presided over the careers of London's less dazzling literary stars, Susanna Yero had the instinct that London was only now waking from a deep winter sleep. In the yellow windows of flats and houses along the lower edge of the hill, she could see people setting about the day. Low above St. Pancras, the sun was doing its best. Her mother would have called it adequate, which was her favourite damnation. Many things were adequate, and none of them was any better than this Monday morning. She turned towards Ormond Terrace, shortening her stride. This was the price of walking to the top of the hill for the view. You had to come down again, along the slurried path, which was perilous even in flat shoes. She kept her head over her feet and spread her arms, hoping no one was looking out of the terrace windows and comparing her with the penguins half a mile away in London Zoo. She had walked to school in snow every winter for the first half of her life. She would not now be defeated by mud.
It is spring in 1963, and George Smiley has left the circus. With the wreckage of the West's spy war with the Soviets strewn across Europe, he has eyes only on a more peaceful life. And indeed, with his marriage more secure than ever, there's a rumour in Whitehall, unconfirmed and a little scandalous, that George Smiley might almost be happy. But control has other plans. A Russian agent has defected in the most unusual of circumstances, and the man he was sent to kill in London is nowhere to be found. Smiley reluctantly agrees to one last simple task. Interview Susanna, a Hungarian migrant and employee of the missing man, and sniff out a lead. But in his absence, the shadows of Moscow have lengthened. Smiley will soon find himself entangled in a perilous mystery that will define the battles to come and strike at the heart of his greatest enemy. Set in the missing decade between two iconic instalments in the George Smiley saga, Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Carla's Choice is an extraordinary, thrilling return to the world of spy fiction's greatest writer, John le Carré.
When she reached the office, she expected to find Mr. Banerjee at his desk, which was the one in the centre, her own to the left and the third to the right. Instead, the door was locked, and she had to open up and turn on the lights, which made her immediately uncomfortable. Mr. Banerjee woke early, the army, he had told her, and performed a series of ludicrous exercises devised by a Swiss. Then he drank coffee, ate whatever they sent from the bakery on the high street, and read books, mostly submissions from new writers hoping for representation. The office was as prim and tidy as the postbag was immense. There was an old English woman called Wright who came late 3 nights a week to dust, with an actual scarf tied on top of her head in the classic style. By the time Susanna arrived each morning, there was always a stack of discarded typescripts on the right side of his desk for repatriation, and very occasionally one on the left side for her attention. The two piles would be separated by the 8x10-inch portrait photograph that was his only personal affectation. It showed a boy and a woman, the print older than the modern frame, and its presence indicated a kind of punctuation mark in his discussion with himself. I have done this work. I have arrived at this point, and now I may rest. But only for a short time, because literature never sleeps.
Carla's Choice by Nick Haraway is read by Simon Russell Beale and runs for 10 hours and 43 minutes.
Last Boy of 66, My Story of England's World Cup Winning Team, is by Jeff Hurst.
I'm sitting in a cafe when a text comes through from my granddaughter, Grace. She has a question for me. Were you still playing for West Ham when you did the World Cup final? Grace is 15 and she's working on a project at school. The brief is to interview an adult about a key event in their life, to ask a series of detailed questions about the impact it has had on them. She's already put most of them to me face to face. It was quite a grilling. But now she's after a bit more background information. Some facts. Yes, I text back. Grace knows something about the big event in my life, but it's hardly her fault that she's unfamiliar with a few of the basics.
Jeff wanted to get down his final thoughts about 1966. He talks about Alf Ramsey, his vision, his drive, his loyalty, also his shyness, even awkwardness. About his teammates, about Jimmy Greaves, hard workers, cool heads, dedicated pros. Jeff tells their collective story, digging below the surface, reflecting on their victory, its impact on their lives. It was a bittersweet onward journey for the boys of 66. Their legacy was squandered and their team uncelebrated. But the 11 of them shared something that no other Englishman has ever experienced. And here Jeff brings them all together one last time to see them make history.
I have been blessed with 5 grandchildren. At the time of writing, they ranged from 35 all the way down to 7. Despite that considerable age span, I hope there's one thing they would all agree on. Their grandpa doesn't spend his precious time with them bending their ear with tales of yesteryear from before they were born, or in Grace's case, from long before her mother was born. But yes, I did play for West Ham United back then. Famously, so did a couple of my teammates on that historic day. It was Hammers who scored the goals, all 4 of them. Another Hammer, the very best of us, set up the first and the last. West Ham 4, West Germany 2. Another text arrives. And who asked you to play for the England team? Or how did you get onto the England team? Alf Ramsey, I reply. Alf Ramsey picked me. Many people know these things. They know that Alf Ramsey was knighted for his achievement. They know he sent out a team that was dubbed the Wingless Wonders. And in their sleep, they can reel off the names of those 11 players. But there are younger generations who, even if they know who managed England, don't know much more. About his vision, his drive, his loyalty. Also his shyness, even awkwardness, and his unease with the press.
Last Boy of 66, my story of England's World Cup winning team, by Jeff Hurst, is read by Jeff Hurst and Robert Farley, and runs for 8 hours and 44 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
In The Things We Leave Behind by Claire Furness. Civil unrest in London has reached an all-time high after years of a growing authoritarian regime. It's no longer safe for Clem and her half-sister Billy in the city. Clem tells of their treacherous journey to Scotland, by road and then by sea, fleeing with nothing but a notebook filled with stories and memories of home. But is there something Clem's not saying? The audio version of The Things We Leave Behind is narrated by Imogen Wilde.
"Just for today," Dad said. "Forget everything else. Just let today be perfect." So we did. We forgot that at 15 I was really too old for a birthday picnic that had become a family tradition when I was 3. We forgot that the weather forecast had said light to moderate showers and a strong breeze were likely in the southeast by mid-afternoon. We forgot that society may or may not have been collapsing around us. Dad cast a spell. We allowed ourselves to fall under it. And my birthday was perfect. He invited the same old family friends every year, and when I was a kid, half my classmates. Now the only school friends to make the invite list were Misha and Danny, my oldest friends.
The Things We Leave Behind is, I suppose it's a dystopian story is what it's been described as, and it is, but I didn't want it to feel like a big sort of distant dystopia. I wanted it to feel really close to reality. I wanted it to feel within touching distance, as though it could be almost sort of, you know, a month's time or a year's time from now, or almost could be happening now if things were sort of just very slightly different. So I really wanted to give it that feeling. And it tells the story of Clem, who's 15 at the start of the story. And we see the story all through her eyes. It's her sort of telling the story of how she and her half-sister Billy have to leave their home in London because there's civil unrest, there's an authoritarian government in control, and Clem and Billy's family is in danger. Her stepmom, Claudia, has been arrested and detained, maybe deported, and her dad, who is a journalist who's critical of the government, he's also having to go into hiding, potentially in danger. So they have to go on the run, and Clem is telling the story of how she and Billy, of the journey that they've made, basically. So they flee to Clem's grandpa's house in this kind of rural, idyllic village, thinking that it'll all be kind of calm and peaceful there. And when they get there, they find it's not quite like that. And they end up having to flee again to Scotland, which in this story is independent. And she knows that her estranged mum is up there somewhere. She hasn't seen her since she was a toddler, so she's trying to get to her. And it's kind of all of those stories along the way of that journey, of all the dangers that they have to face, the people who help them along the way. But all the way through the story, we know that there's this secret that Clem's keeping, that there's something that she can't bring herself to tell. And that is a kind of big part of the story, this mystery that we want to find out what it is that's happened that she can't tell.
Yeah, that secret kind of overshadows the book once you know what it is. Kind of, you
Yeah,
know, it's.
absolutely. And it is really, that is the heart of the story. And that made the book quite hard to write, actually, because it's quite hard to keep a secret for that long. I'm not very good at keeping secrets, those. But yeah, trying to work out how to navigate that, actually, it was a really hard part of the story, because I think when you know that there's going to be something that you reveal at the end of a story, you don't want the reader to feel cheated when they find out what the secret is. You want to feel that you've earned that revelation at the end of the story, I think. So trying to get that balance right of kind of making it feel convincing, and that if you get to the end, once you've found out the secret, that you go back, you can sort of understand it. I think that's what I was aiming for. And you know, potentially some people might work out what it is before they get to that point. Other people haven't. You know, it's interesting talking to readers about how people respond sort of differently to it. But yeah, that was a massive part of writing the story for me, and what made it a kind of quite a difficult story to write, I think, was trying to really earn the right to that revelation at the end of the story. Yeah.
Most years, the picnic wasn't perfect. Not quite. There'd be arguments, or a kid went missing, or was sick, or injured themselves. Or the weather was wrong, because despite humanity's best efforts to set the planet on fire, somehow London on a holiday weekend in May is often rainy. Or the wind turns out to be colder than you expected, and everyone has to try to pretend they're not wishing they'd worn at least one sweater. This day was magical. The sun shone in defiance of the forecast, and we stretched ourselves out like cats, lazy and happy in its warmth. We ate ice gems and cocktail sausages on sticks, and a squashed chocolate cake I'd watched being carefully covered in Smarties by Billy in our kitchen that morning, acting like I didn't notice she was eating half of them. Misha sneaked paper cups of wine for us while Dad and his friends were too busy dozing or having boring conversations to notice, and Danny played football and rounders with Billy and the other little kids, organising them into teams, cheering them on, resolving their arguments until their shadows grew long.
We'll stay completely spoiler-free, so we won't mention it
Yes,
again. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
when did you start writing this book, and what was the inspiration for it?
Well, so the first kind of little seed of the idea of it, I would say, was a really a long time ago, actually, probably, maybe even 10 years ago, that I kind of had this idea for the story. And it really came from everything that was going on in the world around us, about, people being displaced and having to flee terrible events. And I read an article about a Syrian woman fleeing from Syria, and she was describing her life that she'd lived at home before she'd fled, and it was amazing. She was just sort of talking about her life in Aleppo, and how on Sundays that she and her friends would meet up and with their families, and they'd go for brunch and they'd wander. And I just kind of thought, God, that could be my life. What she's describing feels really sort of familiar to me. And then, and she'd been thrown into this kind of catastrophic situation and had to flee. And it really made me think, what would I do in that situation? And think about my family. I've got teenagers, and was kind of thinking, how would they respond in that situation? And I think I really had that feeling of, that's something that books can do, is they can really put you in another person's shoes and see the world through their eyes. And so I was really just trying to get that sense of, I wasn't trying to tell that story. Since then, obviously, kind of everything that happened seemed to be feeding into what I was thinking about in terms of thinking about writing this book. And we had COVID, and we had, the lockdowns, and people fleeing the war in Ukraine, and all of these things kind of fed into what I was thinking about. And this feeling that it's easy to see people as being very different from you, and not relate to them in the same way that you would relate to somebody that you know, and yet, any of us could be in that situation. So I think that was what I was trying to do with this story, was I never want to write a book where you're sort of, hammering a message. It's not really that at all. It's more, I wanted to explore that. I wanted to think, like, what would I do? How would that feel? What would my response be? And to try and see the world in through a, through that lens. And yeah, that was what I was trying to do, really. But in terms of actually writing it, I sort of started just before COVID and lockdown, and then had to kind of stop and put it aside and do all sorts of other things, and then came back to it. And actually, that was quite good, I think, because all of the stuff that had happened in between really then fed into the story, I think.
So it was certainly long before Trump's second term. So were you a bit shocked to see the ICE troops and the lack of due process, and basically your book coming true, not in the UK, but in the USA?
I think, to be honest, I felt it, although it wasn't, yes, it was a long time before Trump's second term and all of that, it's almost like you could feel that happening, or those sorts of, it felt possible that these things could happen. It feels as though the world is moving slightly in that direction at the moment. These things go in cycles, and it feels as though there are a lot of places where these things are sort of teetering on the brink of these kind of things happening. And so although it feels, in some ways, it feels, bizarrely sort of prescient that the book was about that, and now you literally see these things happening. In a way, it doesn't feel surprising because it almost felt as though things were heading in that direction. So yeah, it's kind of horrifying, but also in some ways not surprising, I think, sadly.
Into the writing of the book, are you a plotter or are you a pantser? Was Clem's journey set out or did she take you on a bit of a journey?
She absolutely took me on a journey. Yeah, no, I'm really not much of a planner. I tend to start with a kind of core idea, and then I have a sense of where the story is going to end, a sort of feeling of how it will end, although that often changes, I have to say. But for this story, I had the core of the idea that, it would be about two sisters having to flee their home. I knew also what the secret was going to be, although obviously I'm not going to say what that was. So those kind of key elements were there from the start, and I knew that Clem would also be trying to find her estranged mother, and that that would be part of the story. But beyond that, I just didn't know what was going to happen in between. And I don't even write the book in order, actually. I tend to just write scenes that seem really clear in my mind, and then I look at them and think, okay, well, how do these all fit together? And it's not, at times it feels a bit of a crazy way to work. It's kind of not, it can feel a little bit out of control at times, but actually, for me, I've tried writing in another way. I've tried to be more sort of, to plot more kind of methodically, and it just doesn't really work. So I tend to do that. I tend to just kind of try out all these different scenes and different bits of it, so I've got sort of stepping stones, and at that point I then try to make a bit of a plan to bring it all together. Sometimes I wish that I did it in a more kind of organized, methodical way, but I think you sort of just have to do it how you do it.
Do you have a notebook that you would rescue at the last minute?
Yeah, I've always got notebooks that I kind of am scribbling stuff down in and writing things for, bits of stories or things like that. So yeah, and notebooks are kind of important to me, which I think is why, how that one ended up in this story playing that kind of pivotal role. Yeah.
They are helped by strangers along the way, but they're also betrayed. Was that to do with the COVID reporting your neighbours for having parties type thing?
It was really interesting, actually, because I had that idea, but it wasn't, I think I'd sort of had that idea in my mind before COVID a little bit, because I think there's always that sense of, I don't know, I think I had that sense a little bit, actually, because I've always grown up in cities, and I always feel with villages, I really love the idea of villages, but I always feel a little bit like everyone might be watching you. So I think that kind of played into it. And then again, it was so weird to see sort of that idea just totally, yeah, play out in that. In COVID, that really became a thing, didn't it? About people kind of keeping an eye on their neighbours and reporting on their neighbours. And I think, but again, sort of through history, you can see these things kind of happening. So again, it was sort of using, and I found that a lot with this book, I was kind of using bits from history, bits of sort of imagination, bits of, stuff that was happening now, and kind of trying to weave all that together so that I wasn't trying to. It wasn't trying to just reflect everything that was happening now, but that it ended up kind of doing that, I think.
We are painting quite a dark picture here, but there are
Yeah, we are.
moments of light in the book. Did you need a character like Nisha to bring some laughs into the book?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's such an important thing, especially when you're writing something that is so, it's a serious issue. It's a, it's got kind of very kind of dark elements to it, the story, and very sort of heartbreaking moments, and I really really didn't want it just to feel overwhelmingly kind of bleak. I think that's so important. I think it's important in any story, actually, but particularly when writing for young people, to have that element of hope in there, and also some laughs along the way. And yeah, Misha absolutely fulfilled that role in this book, and I think she's my favorite character, so I just loved writing her and having those kind of moments of kind of levity and just kind of humor that would kind of take it out of of the kind of darker stuff, because I think that's life, isn't it? That even when things are really dark and really sad, you know, there's always those moments of humour and of joy and of, you know, all these different kind of things that, you know, that keep us going. And I think it's so important to reflect that in the story. So yeah, I loved writing Misha. Yeah, absolutely.
I also liked the fact that Scotland was the sanctuary at the end of the journey.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it that felt really right. You know, I love Scotland, so yeah. No, it felt. I lived in Scotland for a year a long time ago, and I've got lots of friends up there. So no, it felt really right that Scotland should be the place of sanctuary.
Now, at the start, we heard from Imogen Wilde reading from the audio version of the book. Did you have any hand in the casting of Imogen?
Simon & Schuster came to me and suggested Imogen. And this is so bizarre, but when they called me to ask me and sort of sent me a sample to listen and to see if I was happy with Imogen, I was actually listening to another audiobook, because I love audiobooks. I listen to audiobooks a lot. And it was being read by Imogen. So literally, as they called me to ask me, I was listening to her. And I was just, yeah, I was absolutely delighted when they suggested Imogen, because I knew she'd be absolutely brilliant. I just, yeah, having listened to this story and was thinking, because I'm really picky with audiobooks actually, about, you know, sometimes I just don't quite get on with who's reading it, or with the combination of the story and the narrator. You know, it's a very personal thing, isn't it? But I was loving listening to Imogen, and so it was complete kind of coincidence and just sort of serendipity that they called and said this. And yeah, I couldn't believe it really. So yeah, I was absolutely thrilled.
But now that it's available in audio and indeed in Braille as well, it's accessible to people for whatever reason don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Really important. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, gosh, as a writer, you know, you just want your work to be accessible to whoever wants to access it, you know. And so I think it's so important, you know, that everyone has the same access. You know, we all know how important reading is and how important stories are. And so to have the kind of, you know, the maximum choice to everybody, you know, available, I think is really so important. So yeah, totally.
One thing we'll miss if we download the audiobook or access the Braille version from RNIB Library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of The Things We Leave Behind?
Oh yes, I can, very happily, because I love this cover. This is my third book, and it's by far my favourite cover that I've had. And actually, my other book's been published abroad and had loads and loads of different covers, and this is my favourite one of all. So, yes, it's a black background. The Things We Leave Behind is written in big sort of white lettering, as though it's been kind of painted on a wall or something in white paint in big capitals. So that kind of dominates the whole of the cover, but kind of all around it and threaded through it is this kind of gold spiral of barbed wire that leads to a little round image of a kind of glowing sunset cityscape with two figures, a tall girl and a smaller girl, representing Clem and Billy in the centre. And around all the barbed wire are these golden paper cranes, which also play a kind of key sort of symbolic role almost in the story. I think it really does an amazing job of capturing the kind of, you know, it's kind of really beautiful, but also quite sort of, it looks quite dark, and it also looks quite exciting. It looks a bit filmic almost, the image of the girls from behind looking out over the cityscape, because as well as being about the kind of dark stuff, it is also an adventure. They're going off to kind of find safety, you know, it's that kind of a story as well. So I think the cover manages to capture all of that. It's by this amazing artist called Michelle Brackenborough, and I can't believe how much she managed to get into this cover. I just think it's such a clever thing. Without it looking too complicated, it's really sort of striking cover. So yeah, I really love it.
I felt a pang of happiness watching him, and I knew Misha did too. She'd never have admitted it, but she'd worried, like I had, that he was drifting away from us. That everything was changing. It was a relief to see the old Danny, like he always had been. It was right. Everything was right. Claudia almost broke the spell. She arrived at the picnic very late, and there was a forced brightness about her, a kind of distracted sadness when she thought no one was looking. She laughed and said she was just tired. It was obviously more than that. Dad put his arm around her, looking concerned. She waved a dismissive hand. "Something at work," she said. "Boring. Now let's enjoy this bloody picnic. Have you lot left me any booze?"
The Things We Leave Behind is available commercially in print, as an ebook, and in audio. It's also available in audio and braille from RNIB Library. And Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The Second World War caused a metal shortage, which had an unexpected effect for Talking Books listeners.
The American Foundation for the Blind sent us a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles. And of course, needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became. So we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits, such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, I return to Blessing Musariri for the Books of My Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I read a lot of Enid Blyton. It was something that we had a lot of in our library that I used to go to. So I think I read probably everything she ever wrote. But the one book that always really struck me was The Magical Faraway Tree. It was about children who'd climb this tree, and at the top of it, they would enter these completely different, fantastical, amazing worlds where lots of interesting things would happen. Like, I always remember the one world was everything was made of candy. So you can imagine as a child, that really took my fancy. It was great escapism for me. And I also loved trees for some reason. I was always in a tree, always climbing trees. And I think maybe a part of it was because I always thought, as somebody who tended to believe in impossible things, I always thought that one day I'm going to climb a tree and enter a different world.
Once upon a time, there were three children, Joe, Beth, and Franny. They lived with their mother and father in a little cottage deep in the country. They had to help their parents both in the house and in the garden, and there was lots to do. Now, one day their mother had a letter. She didn't very often have letters, so the children wondered what it was about. "Listen," she said, "this is something quite exciting for you. Your cousin Rick is coming to stay with us." "Oh," said the children, pleased. Rick was about the same age as Joe. He was a happy boy, rather naughty, and it would be such fun to have him. "He can sleep with me in my little bedroom," said Joe. "Oh, Mother, what fun! When is he coming?" "Tomorrow," said Mother. "You can put up a little bed for him, and you must make room for Rick's things in your cupboard. He's going to stay quite a long time, because his mother is ill and can't look after him." The three children flew upstairs to get Joe's room ready for Rick as well. "Hey, what will Rick say when we tell him about the enchanted wood and the faraway tree?" cried Joe. "And what will he say when we show him our friends there, Silky and Moonface and the dear old saucepan man and everyone?" said Beth. "He will get a surprise," said Franny. They got everything ready for their cousin. They put up a little camp bed for him and found some blankets. They made room in Joe's cupboard and bedside cabinet for Rick's clothes. Then they looked out of the window. It looked on to the dark, thick wood, whose trees waved in the wind, not far from the bottom of the garden. "The enchanted wood," said Beth softly.
The Magic Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton is available from RNIB Libraries as read by Evelyn McLean. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
The book that I tend to go back to quite often is The Alchemist, I think, by Paulo Coelho, because it's a book about a journey. And I love stories about journeys, especially journeys that lead to some personal understanding of life and the way life is sometimes from sort of subjective point of view, but also how destiny and world end up kind of just like all working together.
The boy's name was Santiago. Dusk was falling as the boy arrived with his herd at an abandoned church. The roof had fallen in long ago, and an enormous sycamore had grown on the spot where the sacristy had once stood. He decided to spend the night there. He saw to it that all the sheep entered through the ruined gate, and then laid some planks across it to prevent the flock from wandering away during the night. There were no wolves in the region, but once an animal had strayed during the night and the boy had spent the entire next day searching for it. He swept the floor with his jacket and lay down, using the book he'd just finished reading as a pillow. He told himself that he'd have to start reading thicker books. They lasted longer and made more comfortable pillows. It was still dark when he awoke, and looking up, he could see the stars through the half-destroyed roof. I wanted to sleep a little longer, he thought. He'd had the same dream that night as a week ago, and once again he'd awakened before it ended. He arose, and taking up his crook, began to awaken the sheep that still slept. He'd noticed that as soon as he awoke, most of his animals also began to stir. It was as if some mysterious energy bound his life to that of the sheep, with whom he'd spent the past 2 years, leading them through the countryside in search of food and water. "They're so used to me, they know my schedule," he muttered. Thinking about that for a moment, he realized that it could be the other way round, that it was he who had become accustomed to their schedule. Well, there were certain of them who took a bit longer to awaken. The boy prodded them one by one with his crook, calling each by name. He'd always believed that the sheep were able to understand what he said. So there were times when he read them parts of his books that had made an impression on him, or when he'd tell them of the loneliness or happiness of a shepherd in the fields. Sometimes he'd comment to them on things that he'd seen in the villages they passed. But for the past few days, he'd spoken to them about only one thing. The girl, the daughter of a merchant who lived in the village that they would reach in about 4 days.
The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho is available in the RNIB Library as read by Nigel Grail. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but some you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
In terms of recommending, I think I always think about The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, even though it's not something I've most recently read. But it's one book that I always tell myself that I want to go back and reread. I think I read it at a time when I wasn't really paying attention. It was one of the very first sort of YA books I read a long time ago. And I liked the fact that it also appealed to adult audiences.
This is a murder mystery novel. Siobhan said that I should write something I would want to read myself. Mostly I read books about science and maths. I do not like proper novels. In proper novels, people say things like, "I am veined with iron, with silver and with streaks of common mud. I cannot contract into the firm fist which those clench who do not depend on stimulus." Footnote 1. I found this book in the library in town when Mother took me into town once. What does this mean? I do not know. Nor does Father. Nor do Siobhan or Mr. Jevons. I have asked them. Siobhan has long blonde hair and wears glasses which are made of green plastic. And Mr. Jevons smells of soap and wears brown shoes that have approximately 60 tiny circular holes in each of them. But I do like murder mystery novels. So I am writing a murder mystery novel. In a murder mystery novel, someone has to work out who the murderer is and then catch them. It is a puzzle. If it is a good puzzle, you can sometimes work out the answer before the end of the book. Javon said that the book should begin with something to grab people's attention. That is why I started with the dog. I also started with the dog because it happened to me, and I find it hard to imagine things which did not happen to me. Siobhan read the first page and said that it was different. She put this word into inverted commas by making the wiggly quotation sign with her first and second fingers. She said that it was usually people who were killed in murder mystery novels. I said that two dogs were killed in The Hound of the Baskervilles, the hound itself and James Mortimer's spaniel. But Siobhan said they weren't the victims of the murder, Sir Charles Baskerville was. She said that this was because readers cared more about people than dogs, so if a person was killed in the book, readers would want to carry on reading. I said that I wanted to write about something real, and I knew people who had died, but I did not know any people who had been killed, except Edward's father from school, Mr. Poulsen, and that was a gliding accident, not murder, and I didn't really know him. I also said that I cared about dogs because they were faithful and honest, and some dogs were cleverer and more interesting than some people. Steve, for example, who comes to school on Thursdays, needs help to eat his food, and could not even fetch a stick. Siobhan asked me not to say this to Steve's mother.
That's Daniel Philpott reading from The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon, available in audio from RNIB. And blessing, Mr. Deary, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2pm or 10pm if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.